This is Chapter 8, Hill of the Ravens. And now, my boy, I've told you why on autumn morns I sigh, as I recall my comrades all from dark old days gone by. We fought the scum and made them run with rifle and grenade. May heaven keep the men who sleep from the ranks of the old brigade. Where are the men who stood with me when history was made? They set us free from tyranny, the boys of the old brigade. They met with Dragutin Saltovic in his dressing room at the Seattle Concert Hall. "Do you like Rachmaninoff, Colonel?" asked the great pianist, his accent barely perceptible after all the years he had spent in the Northwest. He was slim and elegant, his flowing ponytailed mane and his large, sweeping mustache pure white. He sat in an armchair, completely at ease, wearing casual slacks and a turtlenecked sweater, puffing on a briar pipe, swirling cognac and a round-bottomed snifter. "I am doing a special performance tonight with the Seattle Philharmonic and Choir, dedicated to Rachmaninoff's work. We will be starting with the piano concertos and working up to the Requiem. I'm afraid I won't be able to make it tonight, sir, but my wife and I have both heard you in concert before, and my daughter Ava has a large number of your CDs in her music collection. She is a great admirer of yours," Don told him. "I will be happy to procure you and your family tickets to any of my performances once I return from Europe. So, tell me, how may I be of assistance to the Bureau of State Security?" asked Saltovic politely. "We're working on a somewhat unusual case. It involves something that occurred during the War of Independence. If you don't mind, sir, I'd like to get a little background on your personal involvement with the Revolution first. We have our files, of course, but it's always more instructive to hear these things firsthand." "Certainly," said Saltovic, with a shrug. One did not rush boss. "How did you end up with the NVA?" asked Redman. "When I was a child, I heard the American bombers coming for us in Belgrade," Saltovic told them. "I was 6 years old. One night the sound of the jets was especially loud. There was a great flash of light, and I knew nothing more for a long time. I am told that electronic sensing equipment heard me crying beneath the earth. It took the rescue parties almost 2 days to dig me out, during which they themselves were bombed and strafed several times by Americans, and some of them died, so later their lives had to be added to my accounts payable as well. They haunt me in some ways worse than my own blood, those brave and simple working men of Serbia who never knew me or my family, who owed me nothing, and yet who kept on digging and seeking a crying child beneath the rubble, even while Bill and Hillary Clinton's power of darkness came for them and butchered them one by one. The men finally found me, and I lived. None other of my family did beside myself. My father and my sister were never found. At least, nothing that could be identified. But afterwards, I swore on the grave of my mother and my brother that someday the Americans would hear me coming for them, and that they would know the fear and horror I felt during those days. It was the oath of a child, but I meant it. Fortunately for me, one of the house mothers at the orphanage where I grew up was an elderly Orthodox peasant woman from the countryside named Dorada, who remembered the old ways, the old truths from the time of our fathers' fathers, when men could speak such truth without fear. She would come to me at night when I had bad dreams about the American bombers, and she would sit by my bedside, and we would talk very quietly. She told me about the Jews, so that I came to understand that it was not only America that was my enemy, but also that evil alien race who are the enemies of all mankind, the enemies of all life. I kept that promise of vengeance, Colonel. In my youth, I became a Muslim, of convenience for a time. I pretended to be Bosnian, so that I could fight against the Americans alongside the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and later on against the Israelis in Palestine. Then I heard that white people of the Northwest had revolted against Zog. So I became a Christian again, and crossed into America down by El Paso, on what was then the Mexican border before it moved north. I was caught by the U.S. Border Patrol, but then I pretended to be a Turk. I didn't speak any Turkish, but neither did the Border Patrol, so they had no clue that in my jabber I was describing to them in Pashtun the various obscene and improbable acts their own mothers had performed with goats and horses. At that time, the secular puppet government of Turkey were the only reliable Muslim allies with Zog against the Saudis and Afghans and the Palestinians and the Iraqis. So they had special orders to ignore Turks, and they let me go. I made my way northwest to Seattle and made contact with the local Serbian community. In the orphanage, we had no computers or television, only music, and I had come to love music as the only sign I could find that there was either a God or an Allah. I worked as a piano tuner for several months. One of my customers was a family of very rich Jews on Bainbridge Island. They had a magnificent Steinway and a beautifully restored 17th century harpsichord made by Stefano Foreggio of Pavia. The Jew boasted that the harpsichord had been liberated by his grandfather from a German Schloss of some kind during Second World War. Eventually, I met a man whom I had reason to believe I knew where I could find the NVA. I told him I wanted to meet one of their commanders. The man said to me, "But why would they want to meet you?" I told him, "Because I have something for them." After some delay, I received a call from a man who told me to be in a boathouse on Lake Union at midnight. I came there at the appointed time, and I met Tom Murdoch. I had a bag with me, and this caused Commandant Murdoch and his men to point their weapons at me in suspicion. Murdoch asked me what was in the bag. I told him it was my admittance fee into the Northwest Volunteer Army. He became angry. He said, "Yeah, we need money, and that's a fact, but nobody buys their way into the volunteers." I disagreed. "I think you will find this an adequate price," I told him. They opened the bag and found the head of the Jew with the Steinway. After they had finished laughing, Murdoch told me, "I'd take your price, mister, but I'm afraid I don't have change. All I got on me is two nigger heads and a Filipino dick." I shrugged and told him, "So keep the change." And then those mighty men laughed even more loudly, and I was sworn in. "You got in cheap. Osiog Levy would have sent you back to kill the rest of the family and burn the house down," observed Redmond sourly. "Oh, I had already done that," said Saltovic airily, waving his hand. "But I only had one small bag." Right. "So you fought with the column until the disaster. Then where?" "Then with Number 1 Seattle Brigade, as I suspect you know, Colonel, since you tell me you have examined my military records. Then I spent a time just after Longview with Charlie Randall, where I carried out special assignments." "Including the capture of Hillary Clinton herself, I believe," asked Redmond. "I recall Corey Nash mentioning you once." "Yes, that foul hag was attempting to influence her weak-minded daughter to abrogate the treaty and resume the war, and that could not be allowed. Randall saw a window of opportunity during an enemy political conference. I was able to infiltrate into the Denver Hilton by posing as a waiter, and the rest I am sure you know. By the way, that man Nash is insane," commented Saltovic. "Sir, I am aware of the fact that Mr. Nash's treatment of Miss Clinton has been characterized as excessive even by some of our own historians," said Redmond cautiously. "I am not sure myself whether he was left alone with her by accident or by design. I have always avoided asking. In any case, it should have been better handled, and I have stated that opinion personally to President Morgan. But she was a wicked woman, and she deserved punishment, and if I may speak from my own personal knowledge, Mr. Nash has a story rather similar to your own. Yes, Colonel, he is a Rhodesian. I know what happened to his family. Nor do I, of all people, dispute that Hillary Clinton deserved death 1,000 times over. She sent the bombers to Belgrade, after all. I do not criticize Mr. Nash or deny that I am very grateful to him. I am simply making an observation. I know the difference because I could see it myself. There is a difference, sir, between evil and crazy. I am an evil man. Corey Nash is simply mad. I understood my own situation, and since the end of the War of Independence, I have attempted to rectify it. I have tried to stop being evil and rejoin the human race through music. I hope I have at least succeeded somewhat. I kept my vow to avenge my family, Colonel, but after I had kept it, I knew that my parents would not have wanted me to live on in nothing but hatred and violence. My father was a cultured and gentle man, who I later learned always did his best to try to make peace between the various nations of Yugoslavia. There comes a time when vengeance must end, sir, or else the enemy has destroyed yet another soul. I left the NVA when my duty was done, and I devoted the rest of my life to music, except when I was called up during Operation Strikeout, when I was attached to the military agitprop and Psywar office. I know most Eastern European languages, and I was able to help persuade the many Eastern European immigrants in British Columbia to support the Republic. Not that they needed much convincing in the view of the persecution to which they were subjected by the Ottawa government and the BC provincial regime. Now, Colonel, may I inquire as to the exact purpose of your visit? If you have access to my files, you probably know more than I do about my own career with the NVA, since I have forgotten quite a bit in the past 30-odd years. How may I help you? You are one of the 8 survivors of the Olympic Flying Column, replied Redman. Yes, said Saltovic, turning his head momentarily. He put his hand to his mouth. That was a terrible time. The Republic lost some of the finest men and women who ever fought for us all. I'm sorry, sir, but they were good friends. One especially. I assume you have some reason for reminding me of them. Mr. Saltovic, we need to speak of the events surrounding the destruction of the Olympic Flying Column during the War of Independence. Why? Demanded the pianist. Trudy Griner is coming back to the Republic on October 22nd, Redman told him. Saltovic seemed to freeze. She says she is innocent. She is demanding a public trial. What? Keep her away from me, whispered Saltovic, his face suddenly going completely ashen. I don't know what you intend with this, Colonel, but do not ask me to go anywhere near her. I cannot. I swear to God that if you do, I will find some way to kill her. I still remember some of those things. How to kill. Dear God, how could a woman so beautiful be so evil? He looked up. His eyes had suddenly become almost insane. But I want to be there when she is hanged, he snapped. If that is your wish, sir, and if the security court finds her guilty, then you would certainly have that right, said Redman, neutrally. We need to be sure of our ground, though, and go over once again what we do know about what happened. You drove the mortar truck from Hoodsport down to Port Orchard? Yes, it had to be me. I was the only one with a full CDL license. I licensed to drive an 18-wheeled vehicle, in case we were stopped. If that happened, I had all my documentation, and we would just hope to God they didn't look inside the PVC pipes or notice that rather odd steel bar arrangement just behind the cab, the lift we would use to raise the mortar tubes into their firing position. How did you manage to get that license? Asked Nell. How did you pass the ID and background checks? It wasn't real. I had one forged when I was looking for work in Seattle. It was good enough to pass, and if it didn't, the cop who pulled me over just figured I was another foreign immigrant talking gibberish and would always take $50 to ignore it. My driver's license wasn't real either, but in those days all you had to do is talk like a foreign fool and the cops figured you were just another illegal. Since local police were forbidden to enforce what was left of the United States immigration laws, in some cases it was actually better to be caught with a forged document than a real one. I am a good American. I come this country for freedom. God bless America, is greatest country in world. You get the idea. You and Frank Palmieri drove the mortars, asked Redmond, with Ed and Brittany McCandless driving your forward scout car. Yes, said Saltovic. Young Vitali wanted to go with me. He wanted to lay the mortars and fire them off. Like all young men, he enjoyed large explosions. But Commandant Murdoch vetoed that. Why? Asked Redmond. Because, Saltovic chuckled, shaking his head. Because I think he felt I might not be comfortable with Volunteer Vitali, or him with me. Because Bill Vitali is the illegitimate son of William Jefferson Clinton, the man who sent the bombers that killed your family? Asked Redman. Bill didn't send the bombers. Hillary did, said Saltovic again. That is why I told you I hold no grudge of any kind against Mr. Nash, even though my personal opinion of his mental stability is not good. Even in those days, before all the research and exposition done by the Republic's historians, we knew that this was true, that Hillary was responsible for the attack on Serbia. I knew it was true long before I came to America, although Clinton certainly is just as morally guilty of my parents' death as was his evil wife. He went along with it. Commander Murdoch was actually incorrect in trying to keep Vitali and I apart. Despite a history of vendetta among the Serbian people that rivals that of the Sicilians, I personally do not believe in transferring the sins of the fathers to the sons. If you want to know the truth, I found the presence of Bill Clinton's bastard progeny in the ranks of the NVA to be an amusing and edifying twist of fate. As to young Vitali himself, I liked him. Somehow, I understood that he was aware of what his father did. But he was always too courteous to try and speak to me about it, and I found that very mature and honorable of him. After all, what could he say? Gee, Drago, sorry my father was a berserk tyrant who slaughtered your family. I understand. Now, the NVA men who ferried your two vehicles across Hood Canal, did you know them? No, that often happened. People appeared out of the mist, sometimes quite literally in this land, and then disappeared after doing what had to be done. Their identities probably aren't important, since it was the main column that was ambushed and not the mortar truck. Do you have any idea why the mortar vehicle was sent into the attack zone separately with such a small team of volunteers, or why Murdoch kept the rest of the group together? No. Why? Is that important? The only reason I can think of why he might do that is if he were expecting the main column to be ambushed, said Redmond thoughtfully. But if that were the case, why did he walk right into it? Murdoch was never that careless. It just seems odd to me. We have already interviewed Frank Palmieri and the McCandlesses, and I think that we have a pretty fair idea of what happened during your heroic assault on the courthouse, which jibes with our official military history of that day. We were not heroes, said Saltovic. We were simply doing what had to be done. None of us could have lived with ourselves if we had run away from the destruction of our brothers and sisters without striking a blow to make sure their deaths were not in vain. Redmond spoke again. Mr. Saltovic, there's another angle we're looking at in our investigation. That's the possibility that what you might call a lover's triangle between Commandant Murdoch, Melanie Young, and Trudy Greiner might have some bearing on what happened at Ravenhill. It goes to motive, you might say. I know it's been a lifetime ago, and believe me, sir, I'm not just fishing for idle gossip from the long-dead past. But what can you tell us about the relationship between Trudy and Murdoch and Melanie in that sense? Trudy Greiner was an extremely beautiful young woman, said Saltovic. That I will grant her freely. Yes, it is my understanding that when I first joined the column, she was Commandant Murdoch's mistress. One has a feel for those things, you understand. And then there came a time when there was a perceptible change, just after Melanie Young arrived. We all knew, of course. You cannot keep secrets in such a close group of people who live in one another's pockets and share the daily danger of death. Did you yourself feel any attraction to Trudy Greiner? Beyond the ordinary admiration of a normal man for such a woman? No, said Drago. There was another one of the female volunteers whom I loved, a French-Canadian girl. Her name was Gina. That story is not relevant to your inquiry, Colonel, except insofar as it tends to indicate that I am capable of judging the situation between Commandant Murdoch and the other two objectively. Gina died with our comrades on that morning, but she lives on in my memory. In my heart, she is forever 19. Next question, please. Did you ever speak of religion to Commandant Murdoch? Asked Redmond. Were you aware of the fact that he wore an Imjalner on his person and seems to have been a follower of the old gods? I seem to recall that. He did, yes. There were men and women of all different Aryan religious persuasions in the NVA, Colonel. Many of us were there, in fact, because the dictates of religious faith demanded it, and we felt a duty to God or the gods, as well as to mortal men, to fight against the tyranny of Zog. I myself once fought against Zog in the name of Allah, as I have told you. But to most of us, it did not matter why our comrades were there, so long as they were there. There must have been exceptions, asked Redmond. Dr. Joseph Cord, for example. Drago shrugged. Joseph could be annoying, Colonel, but he had a very good instinctive feel as to just how far he could go, and he was always careful not to cross that line. And no one has ever questioned his genuine devotion to the revolution. If I understand your hint, no, I cannot believe that Cord had anything to do with what happened to the column. What do you believe happened? Asked Nell. My understanding is that Trudy Greiner is known to have received $1 million from an unknown source the day after the ambush, and it is certain that she disappeared. Why should we doubt the official version of events? Responded Saltovic. If that version is correct, why would Gertrude Greiner suddenly decide to come in from the cold after all these years? Asked Redmond. Do you know what motivated me during the time I was on my quest to avenge my murdered family and my murdered country, Colonel? Drago asked grimly. Most would say it was hate, and yes, there was great hate in me. But most of all, it was guilt. The unreasoning guilt of the survivor. My family were gone, destroyed, and yet I remained behind. Why? Why should they be gone forever, and why could I not be with them? Religious belief aside, sir, one has an inescapable feeling of being cursed of God, that one's survival is not a blessing but a punishment. Have you considered the possibility that this woman can simply no longer live with what she did and seeks to expiate her crime before the eyes of God and man? But she says she is innocent, prompted Nell. Her mind may believe that, said Saltovic. It is even possible, I suppose, that she is innocent, in fact, and that someone else betrayed the column. But I can guarantee you, Sergeant, that her soul tells her she is guilty. She is guilty for being alive, while all those others whom she loved are dead. And how can you know that? Asked Redman. Because there are 8 more like her, said Drago, me and 7 others. We have 1 more survivor to interview, said Redman, as they floated down over I-5 back to Olympia. The one I am most reluctant of all to approach with this. General Willem Vitali? Asked Nell. Yes. I've sent word through military channels that I need to see him, so he knows we're coming. He's still down on the border, and so we'll be away for a night, maybe 2. Sir, began Nell indifferently. I understand this man is your lifelong friend. I'd offer to take over the interview myself, but I am only a sergeant, and it would not be correct for me to interview a general in the SS, nor, frankly, could I muster the necessary officer presence in view of the difference in our rank. As late in the day as it is, would it not be better for you to bring another senior officer into the case? Redman chuckled. In the first place, Sergeant Nell, under Section 30 of the Offenses Against the State Act, that boss brassard you're carrying makes you Jesus Christ and all 12 apostles rolled into one anywhere in this man's republic. As an agent of the Bureau of State Security, you have the legal authority to walk into Longview House right now without asking anybody's permission, and you can ask John Corbett Morgan what he had for breakfast if it is germane to a security matter you are investigating. John Corbett damned well has to answer, and he knows it. He may well have your guts for breakfast the next day, but he has to answer you first. You can go anywhere, arrest anyone, beat the crap out of anyone, or kill anyone if need be, and if you can convince your superiors that it was necessary to prevent 40 million white people from going back to the horror we lived in all those years ago, then you're Jack the Lad. The Republic faces a clear and present danger from the United States, and damn near everybody else in the world, and a society in our position must have blunt instruments at its command to break open the heads of those who would destroy us. That is the only way that an organization such as ours can possibly do our job. Remember, the first rule you were taught on your first day in training when you came out of the Civil Guard to join the Bureau, this revolution of ours is forever. The white race will never, ever go back. And your job is to make damn sure we don't. Technically, yes, sir, I do have that right. But President Morgan's breakfast menu aside, we do live in a real world, you know. Realistically, as regards this case... Look, Hanny, I get what you're saying, and I appreciate it. But no, said Redman, shaking his head. Duty isn't something you pass off to someone else when the going gets rough. That's why it's called duty. It's yours. I had that drummed into my head during my philosophy and moral history class at Sandpoint. It's old man 101, not to mention the core of Aryan manhood. Duty is what being a white man is all about. Duty to family and country. Duty to God. Duty to history. Duty to the folk. Duty to the past and the future. Christ, the citizens of the Republic have duty crammed down our throat, because that is who we are, and that is what we were made for. The Christian identity people call it the yoke of God. The old believers say that a man must dree in his weird. Beyond that, this is something I have to do for myself. If I shirked this, neither Bill nor my own family would forgive me, and I would never forgive myself. It would be like I was afraid to face reality, and that is against the first principle of National Socialist thought. We accept things as they are, not as we would like for them to be. That's us, Henny. That's how we live now. We are the men who did what had to be done 40 years ago, and we do what has to be done today. Where exactly will we be meeting the general? He's down in Sawtooth Hill country. touring the crossings and forward positions and the outposts, checking on readiness, getting a personal feel for what the Mexicans are up to down over the line, that kind of thing. I could wait until he's back, but we need to get this done. You up for a little copter ride? Of course. Good. When we get back to the office, go home and meet me at the Bureau helipad in 2 hours. Change into your bush tackies, and take along whatever weapons or rations or gear you take when you go walkabout. Wherever Big Bill Vitale is, I can guarantee you that business suits aren't required dress. The two boss men, now attired in their own camouflage fatigues, finally ran Major William Vitale of the Special Service to Earth at Outpost 12 down on the border. Redmond and Nell landed at Twin Falls Airport in the small hours of the morning, where they were met by a smaller military chopper and flown to a forward airfield in the rugged Sawtooth Range, about 30 miles to the southeast. Below them, occasional lights twinkled in the cold blackness from the isolated border ranches and farms. From the forward airfield, they arrived at the outpost after a long and bumpy ride in a groundhog, a half-tracked all-terrain vehicle capable of climbing the hills like a mountain goat, crossing a lake, and roaring down a tarmac road at 80 miles an hour if necessary. The driver was an SS sergeant from Vitale's personal staff who seemed to know the way and thought it might be a good idea to see if the groundhog could fly in the dark. Somewhat to Redmond's surprise, they made it in one piece just as the sun rose over the mountains to the east. Outpost 12 turned out to be a carefully camouflaged base camp of tents, prefab buildings, plasma anti-aircraft batteries, and vehicles hidden in a small canyon on the Republic's southern Idaho border. It sat by a rushing stream deep in the rugged forest. The lean larches and aspens with their white trunks seemed to knife into the sky, their leaves bright orange and red. The smell of wood smoke, fresh coffee, and frying bacon and eggs in the outdoors filled the air, mixed with the smell of small arms oil and the indefinable odor of cold metal that always seems to hang over gun barrels and military equipment. The green, white, and blue tricolor of the Republic curled and floated in the cool dawn breeze, and beside it billowed the red, white, and blue flag of the Lone Star State. The soldiers at the outpost included a few of Vitale's SS commandos, but were mostly part of the NDF's 1st Battalion, 32nd Regiment. The 32nd was also known as the Texas Light Infantry, drawn from 1st or 2nd generation Texans, immigrants. These TLI men were considered to be one of the regular Army's elite units, upholding the long and proud tradition of arms of their native land. The Texans wore the standard NDF military camouflage fatigues, but on their heads they wore gray felt Stetsons with their regimental badge, an honor granted to their corps after the Operation Strikeout due to their successful capture of Kamloops and their subsequent defense of the city against over 35,000 Canadian government and UN troops. The day after, the local white underground had revolted and seized the government buildings, 435 Texans from the NDF had parachuted in. They held Kamloops for the next 8 days against overwhelming odds, mostly manning the plasma ray weapons that had brought down the UN and NATO bombers, but also organizing the defense of the hastily erected fortifications and barricades against the Zionist ground troops. The TLI took charge of a ragtag force of over 8,000 white Canadian citizens of Kamloops, ranging in age from 12 to 80, most of whom had never held a rifle in their lives since Canada had imposed over a generation of gun control on her white citizens. But they had manned the earthworks with the NDF rather than be returned to the Zionist government in Ottawa. Without their bombers, the troops of Zog were baffled and reduced to clumsy, half-hearted mass attacks. They had never faced anyone who fought back without air support, and they were beaten back time and again. But the sheer weight of numbers had rendered it a bloody business. Of the 435 TLI from the first 8 days, only 197 had survived. Of the 8,000 Canadian militia, only about 4,000 were alive when the besieged city was relieved by the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler and the 2nd and 3rd SS Panzer Divisions. When the war ended 5 weeks later, British Columbia and Alaska had become part of the Republic. To this day, any Texan who visited Kamloops found that his money was no good there. They were taken to meet General Vitale in his command tent. "Don," said Vitale, in genuine pleasure. He rose from his seat behind a folding metal table and shook Don's hand warmly. He was wearing a trim camouflage field uniform with the SS runes. His general's oak leaves and his Leibstandarte riband with the words Adolf Hitler in Germanic fraktur lettering just above his left sleeve cuff. Big Bill Vitale always slightly unnerved Don and the others who knew anything of history, because he bore more than a passing resemblance to his infamous father at the height of his power, but no one ever dared to mention the fact. "I heard you wanted to talk to me about something, but it must be more important than I thought for you to come all the way out here. Haven't you found any more of my doppelgangers from ONR running around, have you?" "No, not thus far," Redmond replied. "I actually didn't think that character favored me at all." Redmond forbore to tell him that in an effort to fool the DNA scanners at GHQ, the Federals had located one of Bill Clinton's many illegitimate by-blows, who was approximately the same age as Vitale, a broken-down, drunken derelict from Little Rock. Then the Federals had surgically altered him and mentally programmed the man to act as a suicide bomber. Although he had never referred to Vitale's background out of courtesy, it seemed unnecessary for him to know that Don had killed his half-brother. Suddenly, Big Bill's face went slack. "Dio, Don. It's not Tori, is it? Is she all right?" "No, no, Tori's fine," Redmond hastened to assure him. "Everybody back home is fine. That's not why I'm here. Whatever it is, couldn't it wait until our 1022 barbecue at your place?" asked Vitale curiously. "Don't get me wrong. You know I'm always glad to see you. But things are a bit up in the air right now. Is this official? Look, Don, if there's a state security problem going on here in this command that I need to know about, spit it out, man. You can't afford any slip-ups today." "No, it's not really an official visit. I just want to have a little chat, sir. But I'm afraid this is something that has to be taken care of as quickly as possible, and definitely before the 22nd. It's an old case that we're reopening." "And you brought your boss partner for a casual little chat?" asked Vitale with arched eyebrows. "Must be some old case." "Never mind, you'll tell me when you're ready, I'm sure. And in the meantime, I'm forgetting my hospitality. Have a seat, gentlemen. Care for some coffee?" "Real coffee or ersatz?" asked Redmond with a smile. "Real, honest-to-God coffee from the Medford Hydroponics Garden," said Vitale. "That's the one thing we suffer from in the Republic, the lack of a tropical climate to grow proper coffee and tea and tobacco. But the hydroponics guys are really doing wonders making up for it. Our homegrown real stuff costs like hell, but it's available in every supermarket, and I understand they're even going to be reopening Starbucks soon. Won't that be something, after 40 years? And I might add, this isn't special officers' ration either. Any unit I command, I eat and drink exactly what my men eat and drink. No more and no less. Actually, I developed a taste for the acorn brew when I was first married," laughed Redmond. "Sarah has some variations on it. Honey and special magical herbs. We still drink hers at home, but I have to admit, a proper Java is great on a cold morning." Vitale took out a thermos and poured them each a mug of strong, steaming black brew into metal canteen cups and handed it to them. Then came the ersatz instant. "I think it was about 25 before I ever had my first cup of real coffee, and 30 before it had real sugar in it. All the sugar beet crop had to be used to make fuel alcohol before that," Vitale reminded him, sipping from his canteen cup. "Yeah, I remember. You're a hard man to track down in the field, sir. You've implied that this is something more than a routine border post inspection?" "Officially, yes, that's all it is," said Vitale. "Unofficially, I'm here because we're expecting a consignment in sometime today." "I always got a kick out of sanctions busting," said Redmond with a grin. "What's the consignment? Medicine? Electronic parts? Vintage champagne?" "No. We are awaiting a consignment of the most precious contraband of all," said Vitale soberly. 57 refugees from one of the last surviving Mormon fundamentalist communities in Utah. 21 of them are children under 12, including 2 newborn infants. They've been living rough all summer since the Mexican authorities evicted them from their homes in Provo." "Limpezia de Sangre?" asked Don without loathing. "You got it. Not one with what mechs refer to as pure blood can own property or be a citizen of the wonderful Nuevo Mundo Hispanica now. The pale and wicked gringo must be driven at last from the lands of La Raza, so forth and so on. Military intelligence heard rumors of the colony's existence, and we sent Wild Man Mooney down there undercover to try and make contact with them. Now that's a name to conjure with, exclaimed Redman. Rescuing whites from Aztlan is Captain Mooney's specialty, I believe. Yes, for the umpteenth time, Paul Mooney stained his skin brown and dyed his hair black. His Spanish is perfect. You stand next to him, you'd swear to God he was a Cholo. He even sweats Mexican. I beg your pardon? Asked Redman. The War Prevention Bureau, biotechies, have these pills now that these deep cover guys can take, and it actually chemically alters the composition of perspiration so that the body odor reflects the DNA composition of a mestizo or even a negro. I know WPB has agents who can pass for monkoids for short periods of time, but that's a new one on me, said Redman, shaking his head in wonder. It's important. Mooney can now fool a trained police dog as well as other mechs. He has an authentic East L.A. accent. He ought to. He grew up down there, and his hatred for the Spix is total. But with a little alteration, he can pass for one of them, and they haven't caught him yet. He's so authentic, I understand the Mormons damn near killed him when he got into their camp in the Wasatch. Not hard to understand. The Beaners have been hunting them like animals for some months. Mooney was able to persuade them to come home easy enough. They were about ready to try and run the border on their own anyway, although there's no way a group that size could have made it past the minefields. Mooney took command, and they've made it on foot up to a point about 12 miles from here on the Mexican side, where we were able to infiltrate and get them a dirt bus and a couple of SS men for the last run home. They were supposed to take the gap this morning in the hours of darkness, but they had a delay. The two infants are now three, a little white boy who was born at 4 o'clock this morning. Mooney has a communicator, and he brought us up to date. He's decided to try and take the gap in daylight, as dicey as that is. The other side is swarming with Mexican patrols, and they now have a unit of Chinese helicopter gunships on the border. The mechs don't savvy heat-seeking infrared sensors, but the Chinese do, and Wild Man didn't feel comfortable waiting another day at the jump-off for nightfall. There's no way that where he was, he could have been defended long enough for us to go pull them out. He's coming down from the mountains with all of them in the bus, and he's going to break cover and make a flat run for the Keziah Crossing checkpoint. Right under their noses? Asked Redman. Isn't that risky as hell? Yeah, I'll grant you, the danger's not small, but better than risking another day hunkered down like sitting ducks. Here. Vitalik gestured to a map on the desk before him. Both of the boss men leaned over the table to look at it. You can see, it's only about a mile of open country. We've given him our latest poop on where we think the Mexican minefields are, and that bus is souped up and mine-proofed. Water in the tires, the floor lined with heavy nylon conveyor belting. With any luck at all, they should be able to make it before those dozy borderos realize what's happening. There's only two things that worry me. One is those damn Chinese choppers. We can spot them on radar and by satellite, bobbing up and down over the woods and the prairies. They're keeping their noses low and looking hard at what's on the ground, which is their mission after all. But my guess is that once Mooney breaks cover, he'll be halfway to the line before they even see him. Second thing is that the Mexican commander on their side this month is the United Nations General Alfonso Castaneda. He's a monster, but he's smart and he's tough, and it's never a good idea to underestimate him. Him and I have a history. I know, Castaneda, said Don, his voice suddenly growing cold and hard. He has his own ideas about how to cure limpezia de sangre. His treatment of white women is, well, you know what he does. Oh yeah, I know what he does. But with any luck, he won't catch any of these Mormon girls today and unpurify their blood. As you can see, we have a reinforced company of TLI. Air mobile with Valkyrie gunships to give them cover. The Valkyries are packed and armed and warming up just down the creek here on a little LZ the engineers dug out for us and camouflaged. Pull down a few nets and they can be in the air at the drop of a hat. We're hidden up here in the hills so the mechs don't spot us from one of their border observation posts and figure maybe something is up. And the heat shield should blur or block any satellite surveillance from the US or Chinese orbitals they may have access to. We can be over there in a matter of minutes if we can get an adequate warning and a good fix on Mooney's position. Besides that, we have a battery of self-propelled 88s at Kazaya. Once he leaves the starting gate, Mooney will be in range almost all the way, and those 88s can discourage any pursuit. Now we're just waiting for news. It should go okay. Mooney is an expert at this sort of thing. A legend is more like, said Redmond. I have always wanted to meet Captain Mooney, said Nell slowly, turning his coffee cup in his hand. He got my sister and my niece out of South Africa. Mooney entered the country, Azania as it is called now by the Kaffirs, by posing as a Mexican delegate to the 24th World Anti-Racist Congress. He made contact and brought as many as he could home with him. Mooney flew an ancient Russian transport plane directly from a secret airfield near Germiston, with over 200 Afrikaners crammed into the hold like sardines, almost suffocated by the smell of the extra fuel. He evaded the Chinese fighters, and he got out over the sea. He was the only pilot available. The man who was to be co-pilot had been captured by the Chinese and tortured to death. Fortunately, the man who had had to hand-pump the drums of jet fuel into the aircraft's tanks to refuel it did survive. The flight took over 26 hours, almost all of it over the Pacific. No airfield along the way would let the aircraft land to rest or refuel. Anna and Luwetja Nell sliced open Mooney's trousers with a knife, and they took turns massaging his legs on the foot controls and pouring coffee down his throat, slapping his face and shouting in his ear so he would not fall asleep. He brought the plane down at Luftwaffe Airfield in Astoria. It was a perfect three-point landing, using only two of the four engines and those two running on fumes. He asked Anna if his work was done. She told him it was done. Then Mooney passed out and did not wake up for 30 hours afterwards. I always wanted to thank him for that. Just after he left, the 24th Anti-Racist Congress incited more massacres of whites throughout South Africa. What was left of my family did not survive. Jesus, whispered Don in dismal wonder. All those years before the revolution, the old man begged our people to come home. Begged and pleaded, cajoled and cursed, berated and mocked and threatened, anything to get them to come to the homeland. Most of them sat on their lazy asses in the United States for how many years? 5, 10, 15? When at any time they could have gotten up, packed their gear, and come to our people's home, legally. Now our people from all over the world risk their lives every day to come here. In some countries, a white person can be sentenced to death for any attempt to emigrate to the Northwest Republic, sent to prison for so much as speaking about it. In the United States, it's a felony hate crime. You know, sometimes I wonder if there are any of those left back there who heard the old man's call back in the old days when they were young, who didn't come when all they had to do was pack their suitcases and hire a moving van. And now, if there are any of those old people left, do they turn on their TVs and see white people running the border, the mines and the sensors, and the fences and the razor wire, the helicopter gunships and machine gun nests to get here? I wonder what goes through their minds. I wonder if they understand what a precious gift they threw away in their confusion and their laziness back in the early part of the century when all they had to do was cut out all their stupid crap and listen to the one voice of desperate illumination calling them from the Northwest. I can tell you, they would have given anything if only they had listened, replied Nell. I come from the remnants of an entire nation who wish with all our souls that we had listened in time to heed the call to act instead of talk. We talked instead. We swilled beer, and then talked some more, and then swilled some more beer, until we fell down onto the ground like drunken swine while our land was stolen from us by the beasts of the field. We listened to people like that buffoon Terry Blanche, or we listened to no one, and we ordered another lion lager in the hotel bar. And in this country, we listened to wretches like William Pierce and that old bald-headed drunk down in San Diego. What the hell was his name? And dear God, how we paid for it! How we paid, said Don, with a sigh and a sad shake of his head. Why, Why in God's name did we not listen to that one voice of sanity that called for us to quit fucking around and come home? Vitale leaned forward on the desk. Look, Don, we may not have much time, and I know beating around the bush when I hear it. What's up? Why are you two here? Bill, look. Oh, Christ, I don't know how to say this. Back when you were a volunteer during the rebellion, you were with Tom Murdoch's Olympic Flying Column. You were one of the 8 people who survived Ravenhill. Yes, I am, replied Vitale, curiously. You know that, Don. You've known it all your life. And now you come all this way to ask me about it? What the hell's going on? That is the case that has been reopened. What do you mean it's been reopened? Asked Vitale in genuine puzzlement, not comprehending what Don was saying. I need to interview you about what happened at the meeting that occurred at the Hoodsport safe house in the early mornings of August the 1st that year, and the things that happened before it. You need to talk about what? Vitale's face was blank. Sorry, Don, maybe I'm a bit groggy this morning, but that was more than 30 years ago. I was a teenager still, fresh off the plane from Sicily. What on earth are you talking about? Trudy Greiner has contacted the office of the state president. She says she will enter the Republic on October 22nd at Mountain Gate in California, explained Don. She says she is innocent. She is demanding a public trial to prove her innocence, or guilt, as it may be. I am looking into that whole episode, and frankly, I'm finding some things that don't add up. I need you to tell me everything you remember about that time in your life. Ah, comes the dawn, said Vitale, softly. This really is an official visit. The Olympic Flying Column was betrayed by an informer, Don. We always knew that. If it wasn't Trudy, then the Stukach must be someone else. Most likely, one of the 8 of us who survived. God damn it, Bill. I didn't mean... Then you shouldn't have meant, said Vitale quietly and forcefully. Look, Don, you and I have both had much to do our duty in lives. I've always tried to do mine, and now you have to do yours. There is no need to be in any way any diffident or ashamed. Ask your questions. I have nothing to hide, and I'm not worried. Vitale's face clouded. Don, all my life I believed that Trudy Greiner was responsible for what happened that day to some of the finest and bravest men and women in the history of our people. Commandant Murdoch and Melanie Young were like my own brothers and sisters back in Sicily. Hell, all of them were. I have hated Trudy Greiner in my heart and desired her death all these years. I still can't believe she's claiming that she wasn't guilty. But if she's not, and if I have been wrong all these years, then I want to know as much as you do. If I owe her that kind of apology, then I pray to God that both she and I live long enough for me to make it in person. Now ask me what you want to know. The first thing I want to know is the first question I am asking everyone. How came it that you were not with the column when the ambush at Ravenhill Ranch went down? I was in the main column scout car, or rather, scout truck, with Lars Frierson. Why did Murdoch pick me? Lars and I were kind of buddies, and I think that's just the way it played out. I wanted to go with the mortar truck, but the only guy we had who had a full CDL was Saltovic, and yes, we know. There wasn't any reason Drago and I couldn't have been alone together on the mission, at least not on my part, and I'm pretty sure not on Drago's part either. We always got along fine when we were with the column, and I've met him a couple of times since then. There's never been any bad blood between us, although God knows he had reason enough, Vitale felt compelled to add with a sigh. I've always admired and respected him for that. But I guess Murdoch just figured what was better to be safe than sorry, and so he kind of always made sure it never happened. Nothing at all was ever said, ever. But Drago and I were never assigned to anything that required close personal contact. Yes, we've already spoken to former volunteer Saltovic and with Colonel Frierson. What puzzles me, Bill, is a military question you're probably the most qualified of them all to answer. Why Tom Murdoch, who was ordinarily such a cautious commander, seems on this one occasion to have put all his eggs in one basket and moved the entire column, mostly in daylight, in one comparatively vulnerable convoy of only 4 vehicles total. Can you shed any light on that? Well, said Vitale slowly, the only thing I can offer there is just a fragment of something I overheard between Murdoch and Mel Young just before we moved out from the lumberyard where the vehicles were. I forgot about it for years, and when I did remember, it was just ancient history. That's more than we've gotten so far, said Redman. Something about secondary targets after the courthouse. We were all given briefings on their locations, vulnerable points for RPGs, security, etc. I got the impression that the last minute, the operation had become a bit more extensive than originally planned. We were really going to do a number on Port Orchard, the special criminal court, the phone company, the cop shop, the whole nine yards. Take a lot more than the 50-odd volunteers we had, so we were hooking up with reinforcements. What reinforcements? Asked Nell. Murdoch asked us to make sure our CB radio in the truck worked. It did. He went back to Melanie, and I heard him say something like, we should run into the PT boys just past the Ravenhill access road, but if I don't see the signal, we pull off and I'll send the scout up the road to go look. The impression I got was that we were going into a combined op with the Port Townsend flying column, and that Corby Morgan and his men were supposed to be meeting us at some rendezvous point somewhere down Ambush Alley, where we would presumably get our final assignments and dispositions. Don Redman's blood suddenly ran as cold as ice water. Bill, Corby Morgan and the Port Townsend flying column were nowhere near your operational area that morning. Yeah, I know, said Vitale. I found that out later, so I always figured I must have misunderstood what I thought I heard. Anyway, just past the Ravenhill access road, Fatty sprang the trap. We heard the gunfire. We couldn't actually see what was going on over the hill. We couldn't actually see our brothers and sisters dying. We knew damn well with all that heavy fire it had to be bad, but we couldn't do anything. And we somehow convinced ourselves they had bought their way out of it. Hell, this was Tom Murdoch and Melanie Young. They were the best. They could fight their way out of anything. So we obeyed General Order Number 8 and we left. Lars Frierson made me E&E with him. You told me about that once, Bill, many years ago. Anything to add? No, said Vitale. I've been a soldier all my life. That's the only time I've ever run away. I know it was complying with General Order Number 8, and I know it was necessary, but I don't think I've ever really forgiven myself deep inside. There's something else, began Redman, hesitantly. Bill, I have known you for many years now, and I have never uttered one word to you on this one particular subject. I am deeply sorry that I have to do so now, but I have to ask. We are dealing with a matter of treason against the state and the race. It's my job. Ask your question, ordered Vitale. Your father was the President of the United States. He would not go on. Vitale looked at him with a face of stone. Yes, Don, you are quite correct. Never once in all these years have you or John Morgan or Sarah referred to my biological parentage in my presence. And I am more grateful than you can know for that. The only time I have ever discussed it with any of you was twice, many years ago, with Tori. Once in Sicily, when I was 12 years old, when she and Tony Stepaglia and a man named Visconti, whom you wouldn't know, came to our home in Castellammare. And once again with Tori privately, after I came here, when she filled in some details. That was enough. I learned all I ever want to know about my birth. I've never even read the old man's novel about it. You want to know if that fact somehow has left me with some kind of emotional or spiritual bond with the United States. Has it? Asked Redman, bluntly. Vitale shook his head. Don, by an accident of history, my biological father was William Jefferson Clinton. But my true father, the man who made me what I am today, was the cabinet maker and leather worker Anselmo Vitale, a citizen of Castellammare del Golfo and the prefecture of Trapani, in Sicily. My true mother was Giulia Vitale. My godfather was Antonio Stepaglia. I did not grow up as an American. I grew up a Sicilian. That is who I am. I have spoken English for most of my adult life, but I still think and dream in Italian. By the grace of God, I came to know my duty and my destiny in this life. I came to this Northwest land as a young man to fulfill that destiny and to repay my debt to your family, to Matt and Heather Redman and to Tori, who saved my life back in North Carolina at the risk of their own, when I was a baby in arms. It is a fact that I have never once regretted for a single moment, in the course of fulfilling that obligation, I became a National Socialist by conscience and a citizen of the Northwest American Republic. That is my family history. It is intertwined with your own. If there was ever any doubt there, then you would know of it without having to ask. As to the other part, my biological father was a coward and a dog, a degenerate drug addict who raped my mother and then murdered her for the crime of giving life to me. In William Vitale's voice was a lifetime of hatred and anger and bitterness an inconsolable loss beyond any help or understanding. Don's heart verged on the breaking point for this terrible curse born so long ago by a brave and noble a man, for he understood that never before in half a century had Vitale ever spoken such words. He was also the President of the United States, Don reminded him. Yes, said Vitale, quietly. I was told the truth at a young age by Torrey and Tony and John Visconti, who were there when it happened. I was given a burden to carry all my days, and I accepted it as the will of God. I have lived all my life in order to try and give some kind of decent meaning to that unspeakable horror from the past. My father was evil, Don. My mother was not. And I have always tried to be the kind of man she would have been proud of. In my home, I keep a collection of every movie Alice Silverman ever made, every advertisement she ever did for detergents or stupid computer toys, every rock video she made as a teenage girl, every interview or talk show she ever did in the 90s. In the blackest moments of my soul, I watch them over and over. Those images on my comm screen are all that I will ever have of her. I will never, ever forgive Bill Clinton for that. Nor will I forgive the government and the society that was capable of electing him, not once, but twice. There is only one political or military implication to that which need concern the Bureau of State Security, Colonel, and that is that I want to place a priority on the NAR reconquering Southern California for the white man. Before I die, I want to place a wreath of flowers on my mother's grave, if it is still there and the Mexicans haven't destroyed or desecrated it. That is the one and only area where I constitute any possible concern to Boss. Fair enough, muttered Don in utter misery. Bill, there's something else. I'm starting to think this angle may be a long shot and most likely isn't relevant in any way, but what can you tell me about the personal situation between Murdoch, Griner, and Melanie Young? I understand that there was a bit of a love triangle going on there. And again, please forgive me, but I have to ask. One of the survivors we've interviewed hinted that you more or less came on to Trudy Griner after Tom Murdoch dumped her. Like a rocket. The minute I knew she was unattached, laughed Vitale, sadly. Just swaggered up to her in my best Italian style and told her, Hey, bellissima, when the time comes, I want a shot. She just laughed and said, Not yet, Valentino. But if and when the time comes, I'll keep your resume on file. Or something like that. Very light, but we both knew I was serious. But who knows what would have happened if she'd given my resume a closer look before she did it. You think she did it? Asked Redmond. Somebody gave her $1 million. The damn sure wasn't the party paymaster, said Vitale. We didn't have that kind of shekels. It was almost 10 years before I got all my back pay from the NVA as a simple volunteer. We do seem to keep stumbling over that $1 million, said Henny Nell, glancing at Colonel Redmond. Suddenly, a young SS lieutenant stuck his head through the tent flap. Sir, we got a bit of a situation developing, he said. Mooney, demanded Vitale, rising to his feet. Yes, sir. They made it to the jump-off point, and he got them all on the bus, and he was taking it nice and slow down the cat roads. But it seems we weren't as on top of the landmine situation as we thought we were. The bus hit one. Left rear tire. The mineproofing held, and there were no injuries on board, but the rear axle is wrecked, and the vehicle is damaged, and the Mexicans have spotted them. Radar says they've got a whole 9 yards closing in on the bus, copters and ground pursuit vehicles. Captain Mooney has been advised, and he's flooring it, but he can't make any speed on what's left of his rear tires, and with a busted axle to boot. He's not even into the DMZ yet. They're going to nail him, sir, and all the refugees. Like hell they are! Vitale ripped the radio from his belt. Fire up the ladies, he snapped into the communicator. All three of them, and both of the transports. Scramble the fire teams. I'll be there in 2 minutes, and we'd damned well better be in the air 10 seconds after that, or I'll have somebody's guts in linguine sauce tonight. Captain Maxwell, do you copy? You get on those boom boys at Kazaya and tell them I want a solid sheet of 88 shells on any damn thing out there that moves beside Mooney. Capiche? You're going to invade Aztlan, sir? Asked the lieutenant with a bemused chuckle. That'll be what, only the third time this year? Yeah, I know. I'm getting out of practice, growled Vitale, buckling on his web gear and strapping on his coal scuttle helmet. Don, you and your Sarge feel like participating in a little international incident? Nothing like an international incident before breakfast to work up an appetite, agreed Don, standing up. Vitale tossed both of them a pair of Schmeisser machine pistols and a canvas bag of magazines apiece. These are Wilkerson kind modified, exclaimed Nell, noticing the odd squarish bulge at the back of the receiver group. Yeah, you never fired the GW Schmeisser? Asked Don. Not the Schmeisser, but I have the range course on the Mark 7, said Nell. By now, they were sprinting down the pathway towards the helicopter pads, following Vitale and the lieutenant. They could hear the whine of the Valkyrie gunship engines starting up. They handle like cartridge weapons. Just load the magazines like you normally would, panted Don. Instead of the normal 50 rounds in the clip, you've got 200 plain copper-jacketed slugs, with butterfly twists on the tip of each slug to make sure anything Mexican you hit turns into guacamole. Jack in a round, and it will chamber against the kinetic energy plate. Pull the trigger, and you've got a burst with very little recoil. Easy to aim and control, no hot brass living about to roll down your inside collar and sting the hell out of you. You can make it like Steve McQueen, German from the old movie, spraying endless bullets from a bottomless magazine and yelling, "Macht schnell!" Unless you'd rather glom a standard-issue Mark 7 rifle. I learn fast, sir, said Nell, slapping in a magazine. Hey, General, if I bag a spick with this, can I keep the weapon? Vitale had no time to answer as they leaped into the cabin of a hovering Valkyrie gunship. The aircraft were floating like lazy dragonflies 4 feet off the ground, their light but bulletproof plastic fuselages painted in camouflage and sporting circular green, white, and blue rondelles on the tail assemblies. Nell and Redmond quickly strapped themselves into the rear rumble seats behind the door gunners, which was lucky for them since the minute they were on board, the Valkyrie's pilot tore away from the landing zone. Vitale swung into his seat like a monkey, strapped himself in with one hand, and was immediately on the comm, demanding a sit-rep and issuing orders. Don looked up over the pilot's head and saw the Valkyrie's traditional runic inscription burned into the metal above the visor. Nell saw it as well and asked, "What is that, Colonel?" "The NDF Aircav's official motto," explained Redmond. "It's an old Viking expression in some ancient Norse dialect that European archaeologists found in the ship burial mound of a king in Denmark, I believe. Those are runic letters. It means, hurry to meet death before your place is taken." "Is this where they start playing the Wagner through the loudspeaker?" shouted Nell over the roaring slipstream. Vitale overheard him. "The TLI doesn't use Wagner," he called back to them. "They have a couple of old country songs from 100 years ago they like." As if in response, there was a sudden burst of sound from the speakers embedded in the chopper's landing skids. Don couldn't catch most of it, but it was some jaunty tune about there being beer in Texarkana, thirsty in Atlanta, and watching a bandit run. It seemed an odd song to ride into battle with, but then Don had always believed privately that Texans were a bit odd. There were 3 gunships and 2 larger armed transports to ferry the refugees back, both of which carried a team of medics. The 5 choppers zoomed in and out among the hills and the canyons, over the trees of red and gold foliage, and all of a sudden they broke out over a spreading flat plain matted with sagebrush and scrubby vegetation, the old country song blaring in the air around them with a twang of banjos. "What is a smoky?" asked Nell. Not sure. It used to be some kind of bear, I think," replied Redmond. Don never ceased to be amazed how quickly the terrain could change here in the border country, both here and along the Montana salience, where he had done his own military service with the SS. 1 minute they were flying through the mountain forests of golden autumn foliage, and now they were flying over a flat prairie. Don twisted around in his seat and tried to catch a glimpse of where they were going. Ahead, he could see the fountains of earth erupting from the red ochre desert floor, and he understood that the choppers were swinging wide and coming in from the south at a high angle in an attempt to avoid the artillery barrage. He couldn't tell whether the shells came from the enemy or the NDF's 88mm batteries. He could not see any sign of the bus full of Mormon refugees, or indeed any motion on the ground of man or vehicle at all. Several bullets clacked and whined off the outer skin of the choppers. "We're being shot at," he told Nell. The distance was short now, and all of a sudden the NDF choppers were over the bus. Redmond saw that an SS man in camouflage fatigues was lying prone on top of the battered bus, a bipod-mounted splat gun against one shoulder. The splat gun was outwardly modeled on the Browning automatic rifle of the previous century, although it weighed about 5 pounds lighter. Instead of ordinary ammunition, it chambered 18-inch-long Wilkerson KE rounds of cadmium steel rod, sliced lengthwise from the top into 8 slender, needle-like sections. When the kinetic energy plate hurled this projectile from the barrel at over 7,000 feet per second, the sections opened and were thrown into a spin, resulting in a spread of 8 whirling buzzsaws that would be 3 to 4 feet in diameter by the time the target was reached. A tank or armored vehicle would be sheared through, and by the time the shards tore through the armor plating, the heat of air and matter resistance would have turned them molten. As for a man, the kinetic force would literally dismember him, hence the weapon's name. "Ugly birds downrange, 5 each, 2 miles in closing," someone squawked over the comms. The 2 transport choppers began settling down on either end of the bus. The door of the bus opened, and a black-skinned, shirtless, Hispanic-looking man with heavy black mustache and wearing patched jeans leaped out. "That's Mooney! Hold your fire!" shouted Vitale into his comm. Medics leaped forth from both transports and began running to the bus in the swirling dust and sand. Wild man Mooney began pulling men and women off the bus and sorting them towards the copters. One left, one right. One left, one right. 2 of the medics grabbed women carrying babies in arms and hustled them towards the open loading doors of the choppers. A rocket plowed into the ground about 50 feet away from the bus and shook the earth, sending a geyser of soil and sagebrush into the air. "Ladies, hit those uglies! Keep them away from that bus!" snapped Vitale into his mic. The Valkyrie surged forward and the bus below them was gone from view. Don looked forward just as the copter pilot leaned hard starboard and soared, then suddenly dived, bringing one of the Chinese helicopters into view in the open door. The door gunner cut loose with his twin machine guns, the 1,000-round drums feeding slim and deadly 180 bullets against the energy plates and spitting them like a water hose. The pilot suddenly barrel-rolled out of a spray of Chinese fire that pattered against the fuselage like deadly raindrops. One of the machine gun bullets came through the door and slammed into the bulkhead a couple of inches to the left of Don's head, making his left ear ring. From that point on, Don lost all track of what was going on. There were long minutes of twisting, soaring, diving, and rolling accompanied by the clatter of machine gun fire, the thud of explosions, and incoherent voices coming off the comm. And then suddenly, the Valkyrie dropped like a stone, hovered briefly a few feet above the desert floor, and set down. "Let's go!" yelled Vitale, jumping to the ground as the starboard door gunner covered him with a long sweep of fire. Redmond and Nell ripped off their harnesses and stumbled out after him. "Go where?" shouted Don. Then he saw that one of the Valkyries was down, black smoke pouring from its methane engine, its fuselage battered and almost shapeless by hundreds of bullets and a hole from an RPG or some kind of shell in the pilot's windscreen. Through the open side door, he could see the starboard door gunner firing at something in the distance. The port gunner hung in his harness, bleeding, and one of the pilots was crawling toward them, right leg bloody and smashed. Vitale and Nell ran for the wounded man on the ground. Redmond slung his submachine gun and leaped up onto the stricken copter. One glance was enough to show him the first pilot was dead. His helmeted head was hanging off his shoulders over the back of the seat by a few white sinews. Don pulled open the portside gunner's harness. As the man slumped forward, Redmond shouldered him, hoisted him onto a fireman's carry, and began lumbering back towards his own Valkyrie. The starboard door gunner there unhooked, jumped out, and helped Don load the wounded man onto the deck and hook a safety line onto his belt. "I'll take care of Harley, sir," the soldier shouted. "Help the general!" Redmond whirled and saw Henny Nell staggering back towards the gunship, half-lifting the pilot with the wounded leg whose arm was around the Afrikaner's neck, half-dragging him. Bill Vitale was in the port-side door of the downed Valkyrie, standing tiptoe on the now-empty gunner's seat and firing at something over the roof, his head hunkered down beneath the still-turning rotor blade. Redmond unslung his Schneisser and chambered a round, Other than a few brief glimpses of the black Chinese helicopters, he hadn't seen an enemy yet. Then he did. 4, then 5, then 6 men in khaki uniforms and OD green helmets came over a small slope at a dead run, then stopped to spray automatic fire at the Northwesterners. Redmond hit the dirt, slipped the cuff over the firing chamber of his Schmeisser, and quickly rotated the long magazine 90 degrees up and to the left so he could better fire from the prone position, snapped it back into place, and cut loose. He saw one of the Mexicans drop, then another, as they were hit by fire from Vitale and starboard gunner on the downed bird. "Don! Let's go!" came a shout. Vitale and the door gunner were now running towards him. Don scrambled to his feet. They reached the door of their own copter. As they leaped in, Vitale yelled at the crewman, "You set the charge?" "Yes, sir. She goes in another 30 seconds. "Shit!" Some sixth sense seemed to warn Don. He whirled, just as another group of Mexican soldiers leaped out of the whirling dust from nowhere. Vitale was on the starboard door guns in what must have been microseconds, and Henny Nell opened fire with his Schmeisser. All of them twirled and twisted and tumbled, except one huge mestizo, who leaped onto Don with a long dagger or bayonet in his teeth. The Valkyrie began to rise rapidly in the air, as Don and the Mexican grappled, half in, half out of the door, the Mexican trying to draw back far enough to stab Don around the protruding machine gun barrels, while Don tried to twist his gun muzzle inward enough to fire and hit the man who clung to him like a leech. A hand holding an old-fashioned Boss issue 7.5 Walther PPK leaned out and fired, sending a bright brass cartridge casing into the air. The Mexican's skull popped open like a piñata, bloody crimson and white bone and brain fragments spraying, and he twirled back down to the earth. Just as the corpse hit, the downed Valkyrie exploded into a ball of flame. Strong hands pulled Don into the copter. "Thanks, partner," he yelled as he strapped himself in. "Dit mach nix," said Nell. The Mormon refugees all made it home safely. They had been fed and warmed and clothed, and the transport copters were revving up to fly them to the reception center in Twin Falls. A gaunt and weary man with a battered slouch hat, a long yellow beard, and wearing patched denim coveralls appeared out of the gloom. He saw Vitale's general stars among the men standing by one of the campfires drinking coffee and eating field ration meals from tin plates. He spoke. "General, my name is Carter Jurgensen, elder of the stake you rescued today. Our bishop was murdered in Provo when they came for us. The man who was killed today, your helicopter pilot, what was his name?" "Warrant Officer James Lawson," said Vitale somberly. "Born in Natchitoches, Texas. Died a soldier of the Northwest American Republic. My son was born at 4 o'clock this morning. Warrant Officer Lawson died to make sure he lived, in freedom. Now my third sister, wife, and I know what his name is to be." James Lawson Jurgensen. Vitale and the men around him raised their canteen cups. "I hope you don't mind a toast and coffee, Elder Jurgensen," he said. "Long life and prosperity to your son, and we appreciate your naming of him for Jim Lawson. In the circumstances, I think the TLI can consider him to be the son of the regiment, so to speak. Do me a favor, will you? In the years to come, keep me posted on how he's doing as he grows, and if I'm still around when he comes of age, and he feels it is the right path for him, I can promise him a berth in the military academy at Sandpoint. For personal reasons I won't get into, I am highly interested in his situation. It parallels another such, long ago." "The saints pay their debts, General," said Jurgensen. "He will be there." On the flight back, Nell was silent until they were coasting downward to Olympia. "What now?" he asked. "We now have to deal with the possibility that Tom Murdoch thought he was going to combine forces with the Port Townsend Flying Column for a major joint attack on every Zog facility in Port Orchard," said Don. "If that is the case, then it would explain quite a bit about his seemingly odd behavior on that morning, why he kept the whole column together instead of splitting into 3 or 4 mobile sections. I would be extremely interested to learn just how Commandant Murdoch came by that impression. I do know that in the almost 4 decades since the ambush at Ravenhill, There was never the slightest hint in any history of those events ever written that the Port Townsend column might have been in any way involved. And since President Morgan was at the time the commandant of the Port Townsend column, he would of course know if there had been any such plan, and he said nothing before or since, said Nell. No, nor did he make any statement to that effect when he was leading the official inquiry into what happened at Ravenhill, said Redmond. This is the first time we've heard of it, and that only by accident. It seems that we have a few gaps in our information, said Nell, neutrally. Gaps that John Morgan seems curiously reluctant to fill in. There is something else going on here we don't know about, said Redmond. I should have mentioned this to you before, Henny, but I wasn't quite sure of what it meant. Charlie Randall told me that about 12 years ago, President Brennan called off the WPP's search for Trudy Greiner. He did so at the personal request of none other than the old man himself. Called it off? What on earth for? Asked Nell, in astonishment. I don't know. I can only assume that at some point, someone discovered something that made it more politically inexpedient than otherwise for the truth to come out. Whatever reason might be, and however unofficially, the government abruptly brought the search for Trudy Greiner to a halt. They must have hoped to hell that she was dead, or at least that she'd stay the hell away from the Republic. Then we get that letter saying she's coming back, and somebody's ass needs covering fast. Brennan is dead, and I have to face the fact that I can no longer rely on the state president to tell me the truth, or at least the whole truth. The fact is, I think we've probably got about all the information we're going to be able to get after the lapse of so many years. There is only one more avenue of information I can attempt to explore, and that is to find out what happened back in Brennan's administration. I'm going to try to get permission to speak with the old man. How will you do that? Asked Nell. I understand he is in complete seclusion and retirement now. Hey, it helps if you're married to the president's little girl, said Redmond. I can go straight to the top without cutting through too much red tape, and inform the head of state that it is necessary to my investigation that I speak with the president emeritus. What if Morgan refuses to let you see him? Asked Nell, skeptically. I say again to you that in the real world there are certain limits to boss's power. General Capshaw could sign an order getting you in to see the old man, to be sure, but he would want to know why. And would he do so if President Morgan objected? If Morgan objects, then we'll know, said Redmond with a shrug. Know what? Asked Nell. We'll know that Morgan knows more than he is telling, and that there is something he doesn't want to come out. Why he gave me this assignment to begin with, if that's the case, I don't have a clue, except maybe I'm supposed to act as a plumber, test for leaks, so to speak. And if that happens, then what? Persisted Nell. We wait for Trudy Greiner to arrive. If she does, and we see how it plays out, replied Redmond. If she ends up as fertilizer without any public trial or any public admission that she was ever here, then that will tell us what we want to know as well. And don't ask me what then, because I don't know what the hell then. When they got back to Olympia, it was past nightfall. Don sent Nell home, but he buried himself in his office in the Temple of Justice. He typed up and printed 2 copies of a short document, put 1 into the file folder on the Greiner investigation, slipped the 2nd copy into his vest pocket, and then called over across the street to Longview House. Is the state president still in his office? Asked Morgan's aide and secretary. Yes, Colonel, replied the young man. He's a workaholic, as you know, but he should be knocking off for dinner around 8. Mr. Nash is cooking up some kind of sausage and greens and mashed potatoes dish. It looks disgusting, but I've eaten it before and it's quite good, and I'm sure President Morgan wouldn't mind some company. This is official business, Captain Barringer, not family, and so I would rather speak with the President in his office. Can you buzz him and ask if I can step over and have a quick word? Certainly, Colonel Redmond. The Captain came back in less than a minute. Come on over whenever you're ready, sir. Don crossed the cobbled plaza and the street to Longview House in the gathering autumn darkness, checking in at the gate and saying hello to a different SS guard and the same Gelf dog. He stepped up onto the portico of the house and was started to feel a hand on his shoulder. Don turned, and in the yellow light from the faux ironwork gas lamp on the porch, he found himself facing old Corey Nash. Nash was wearing the same threadbare blue blazer and flaccid tie it seemed he had been wearing ever since Don knew him, the dress of an alcoholic bellhop or an usher at a seedy funeral home. The old man's rheumy eyes started to glare at him from a leathery face. "Beringer said you wanted to see John C.," said Nash. "I know what's going on. I know what John C. told you to do. What are you going to say to him?" Don looked at him. "Mr. Nash, at the time of Ravenhill ambush, you were sometimes used as a courier between Port Townsend and Olympic Flying Columns. Do you have anything you want to tell me about that time in your life?" "The last time anyone asked me about that time of my life, as you put it, was when you was still trying to get into Sarah's jeans back in Bellevue," said Nash. "Some blokes from the FBI. They used a dentist drill. I didn't tell them bugger all either." Don was suddenly struck by the similarity between the old man's Rhodesian accent and Henny Nell's. "I understand," said Don, and he did. He knew that nothing on earth would force the old codder to reveal anything at all he did not wish to reveal about John Morgan to anyone, and he could not bring himself to try. He turned to go inside, but Nash held his arm. "Don, you know I've never in my life asked anything of you," began Nash, tentatively in an odd, subdued voice. "Not only have you never asked anything of me, I think that's the first time in over 3 decades you've ever spoken my first name out loud," said Don, in amazement. "Yeah, well, maybe that's been a mistake on my part. I'm asking something of it, you know. This business you're working on now. Leave it! Tell JC you've got no idea what the bloody hell's going on, and just walk away from it. There are things in this country's past that just been buried for most of a lifetime, and they need to stay that way. Just leave it, son. Just walk away." Nash's voice was urgent and plaintive in supplication. "Someone has been just leaving it for a long time," said Don. "But now we can't cuff this anymore, Corey. What we do when Trudy Griner walks across the border at Mountain Gate in less than 2 weeks' time, huh?" "We do what was done before," said Nash. "I did my duty then, and I could do it again. You know the drill. You grab her ass, you bring her into a room with me, and you lock the door. You go have a nice long smoke on one of them cigars himself gave you. When you come back, there'll be no more problem." "Trudy Griner isn't Hillary Clinton, Mr. Nash," said Don. "She is, or was, one of us, a soldier in the NVA. She is coming here to be tried in public before God and country on the charges against her. Not to be left alone in a room with you." "Since when did you become so damn high and mighty?" growled Nash. "I'm not. I'll do it the old way if I have to," said Don. "T.T.I. even do it the old way if I'm ordered to. But before I do, I have to know not only that it's necessary, but that it's right. Now that you have a choice, you can either tell me what the hell happened back then, or else I'll keep on digging until I find out on my own. Did Corby Morgan have anything at all to do with the destruction of the Olympic Flying Column?" "Did Morgan," said the old man slowly, disgust in his voice. "You know, son, I thought a lot about you over the past 30-odd years, not much of it good, but until this night I have never thought you were fucking stupid. I got bangers and mash on the stove, and cabbage. Stay to dinner, boy. Cabbage is brain food, and you bloody well need it." The coot turned and stumped around the corner of the porch to his kitchen. Don Redmond found the state president in his upstairs office with 2 sideburned men in 1890s collars and cuffs, stolid in pinstriped broadcloth, and with gold watch chains dangling. He knocked on the door for admission. "Come on in, Don," said Morgan. "You know Jacques Cumeau and Roland Stanford of the Revenue Commission? Gentlemen, my son-in-law, Colonel Donald Redmond of the Bureau of State Security." Don shook hands with the 2 bureaucrats. "Don, do you have any idea what that damn Bismarck floating fortress of Bloody Dave Leech's is going to cost us? I tell you, the folks in this country are lucky that our Constitution forbids any form of income tax. You put a few more pence on the pint and you're going to revive moonshining as a cottage industry," protested Don. "Actually, Colonel, excise is booming. This year we're looking at our best import-export ratio ever," said Comteau with a smile. "The NAR is among the last reliable manufacturers in the world of medicines, high-tech components, and machinery that actually works. The same countries that pillory us on the floor of the UN send us trade delegations sneaking in through Canada begging for our products." Never mind, said Morgan. I'm about ready for some eats. Corey's got some of that cabbage and potatoes and sausage of his bubbling away downstairs. Are we through, gentlemen? Sure I can't persuade you to stay for supper. If not, thanks for coming by. After a few more pleasantries, Morgan ushered the two men out the door under the care of Captain Barringer, and then closed the door to the office. What's up, Don? Asked Morgan. Don surprised him by formally standing to attention in front of his desk. Mr. President, as part of the investigation into Griner's affair which you have assigned me, it has become necessary for me to request your permission to interview the President Emeritus of the Republic. Great jumping Jehoshaphat, boy! What the hell do you want to talk to him for? Demanded Morgan, roughly. You want to listen to some senile old loon babble? I can call in Corey from the kitchen. Or I'll even do in a pitch. Actually, I just had a rather interesting, if somewhat cryptic, conversation with Mr. Nash on the subject. It is a necessary part of the investigation, repeated Don. He handed Morgan the piece of paper he had prepared. I'm making this request officially and formally, in writing. A copy of this request will be attached to my final report and included in the case file. If you decline to grant me permission to see him, sir, then as far as I am concerned, that is the end of the matter. You are, after all, the state president and commander-in-chief. Or I should say, it will be the end of the matter until Trudy Griner arrives on October 22nd, if indeed she does. But if you decline to give your permission, I would like you to so note that refusal at the bottom of my request in writing. I don't expect you to give your reasons, either in writing or verbally, if you should choose not to do so, but I want it on record. And why on earth do you want to nail my hide to the barn door like that? Asked Morgan, incredulous. What the hell did I do to bring this on? Don's reply was low and even. This has nothing to do with hides or barn doors, sir. I want your refusal in writing so that when this clusterfuck, whatever it is, comes apart at the seams and blows up in all our faces, as I have reason to believe it will, then at least it will be on record that I didn't pass the buck. If you see the old man, will you be able to prevent it from blowing up? That depends on what kind of answers I can get from him, if any, and on what kind of sense those answers make, if any. The President Emeritus is of a very advanced age. Morgan pulled out an ink pencil, scrawled something on the bottom of the paper, and handed it back to him. All right, you can go and listen to the mummy mutter. Be out there at 10 tomorrow morning. I'll call ahead and let his honor guard know. Don let himself into the front door very late, accompanied only by the silent Bakersville. He found Sarah sitting alone at the kitchen table in the dark. You were in battle today, she said tonelessly. I felt it. I always do when someone meets you with death in his heart. Yes, he said, sitting down beside her and pulling her head to his shoulder. I also know that things aren't right between you and my father, she said. How bad is this going to get? I wish I knew, Snoops, he said softly. I wish I knew.